Hi, good morning. This is Consuelo, and once upon a time, here we are, and I will start telling you that now is the perfect time to contribute to KBOO of the end of the year campaign, because a generous group of KBOO donors will match your gift one-to-one up to $20,000. You can do it online, and you can do it through mobile app, by text, SMS, text KBOO to 44321. It's important to be generous and to have your contributions, so this way we can keep going with this wonderful program and this wonderful guest. Our phone here is 503-231-8187. And I will tell you when our line will be open for you to call. I am very happy to introduce you to this wonderful writer, woman, grandmother, wife, Betty Lennett Denny. She is right here with us, and she is going to talk about her books, her latest book that is going to be on the bookstore on February. The name of the book is In the Wake of Madness, and here we are. Here we are, Betty. Hi, how are you? I am so thrilled to have you, because you are a good writer. I mean, you have already a tradition, you have a reputation, and I am very proud to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Consuelo. Yes, yes. Appreciate it.
So the first that I am interested to talk about is you as a writer. When did you start thinking, oh, this is something I would like to do, or I have talent for this, or I can try to do it? When was that a step? Were you a child? Were you a teenager? Were you a growing up? How was it?
I think I actually had that inkling when I was very young. Yeah. I wanted to be a writer. I remember doing plays with my best friend in my very small bedroom. But I also had a sense that it wasn't necessarily something I was going to do for a living. I guess that is the practical part of my father. But I did end up using my writing skills for much of my life. Most of my time was spent at a television station and then later doing public relations. So it was a different kind of writing. I wrote documentaries. I wrote public service announcements. I wrote annual reports. But, you know, it wasn't quite the same. And when I retired, I decided that I would try to write for fun. And that has been obviously a very different kind of experience for me. I often think I wish I had started earlier in my life, because I've learned a lot along the way. But it's been a wonderful experience.
Yeah, and how do you deal with the wait page when the idea doesn't come? How is your routine or your discipline? Or you have an idea and then you start taking note. How do you work?
I kind of hate that question. I always hear people ask writers these things.
Yeah,
and I have so little of a routine. It's pathetic. I know that people often talk about, you know, the discipline and maybe taking a portion of the day and devoting it to writing, or making sure you sit there and you work for at least 2 hours, even if it's to a blank page. I think I've always been motivated by whatever it is I'm doing. And I think it is just a sense of curiosity that makes me progress from one step to another, regardless of whether I'm writing fiction or nonfiction, whether I'm doing, you know, research or not. It's just, there's always, ooh, what's going to happen next, which is one of the things I strive for in writing the book, because that's the way I want my reader to feel.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't share very much of that, even I have the curiosity, obviously, but to me, my books has been always to have a certain amount of hour, a discipline. Mm-hmm. That is the reason, because both of them, I was, I would dedicate the whole time to write, mm-hmm. and the other, I was at the university at the same time, and I have 7 children at the same time, and it was perfect, because
sure.
I need to be, yeah, because it's a lonely, lonely work. I mean, you are in solitary writing.
It is.
And how the idea come? How do you see something? You dream about something? Each, how
no,
did the idea come?
I think each of my books has its origins in different ways.
Yes.
If I can.
Sure.
Okay. So the first thing I think I started writing in earnest, in it, and it was maybe in its own way therapeutic for me, were actually the anecdotes of my parents. My mom lived with us until she was 95 years old, so the last 15 years of her life. And in those last years, I queried her a lot about lots of things. And I got a lot of stories, but that's all they were. And she was also kind of on the edge of dementia at that time. Okay. So I really wasn't too sure how verifiable some of those stories were.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was also still very busy, full-time job. And so I kind of left them as anecdotes and even started to write it up as a book. I won't even explain because it was sort of complicated, but suffice it to say, I made it fiction. I changed names because, again, I wasn't sure, but they were interesting stories, and I wanted to at least preserve them for the family. And then after having been through that saga and written really an entire book that I never shared with anybody, I decided I wanted to write something completely different where I wasn't tied to anything factual, at least anything personal in my life.
Sure.
And I also wanted to do something that instead of having this big, long time span, I wanted to do something that was more compact. And so that is actually how Angel Unfolding, which was my first work of fiction, began, because it's kind of within the time span of a year. It was prompted by sort of a combination of factors. There was a case in Iowa, I was living in Nebraska at the time, about a woman who had been abused and who murdered her husband and actually had left him in the house for many months before being discovered. And I didn't know a lot about the story, but it was intriguing to me to think about what would prompt a person to do that. And then I decided I wanted to get the next random thing that hit me and to see if I could make things come together. So I was traveling across country at the time, and we saw a billboard for a person who wanted to donate a kidney, who needed a kidney.
Like the movie. There is a movie, exactly.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah, yeah. And at the time, that was very, just out of the ordinary. And I tried to think about how I could marry these two things together. And the whole story where she starts in prison in Montana, set in Montana because my daughter was going to school in Montana at the time. So, that all just developed, and it was almost, it was just sort of a breaking out for me of trying to do something that was not my norm. But on the other hand, it dealt with a lot of social issues, and that was very much in my wheelhouse, because that's what I had done for so many years.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how the mind works, isn't it? Because it's the mind that is working, that you are putting all this kind of detail or long story or actual stories, and you put it in a pen and you mix everything and then
come out with something entirely different.
It's a creating process, and this is what is the most important thing about it. It's not the final, it's how you get to that final.
Right.
And I love it. I think it's very nice.
And some people really do sort of make an outline for themselves.
Yes.
Even in fiction, they know exactly where they're going.
Yes.
And I must say, I've never written like that. Yes. I know where I'm starting. I know my characters really well because I have to get inside of them.
Very important.
And I kind of know where maybe I want to end, but I have no idea how I'm going to get there.
Yeah, this is almost like you read your own work because you are at the end surprised of the final word. Because you don't know, you don't start with. In that sense, I have done research, and my creative writing is also short stories, a little shorter. And but most of the time, I am surprised also about the end. And I think that is wonderful how the brain work and the thing that you didn't think that you will be able to put together, suddenly they fall up, they fall in a marvelous way.
It's amazed me. Sometimes unpredictably.
Amazed me in a way that still today I feel, I don't know, excited about it. And you said that you have a story about the second name, Leonard. What is the story? Tell us the story.
Well, it is actually part of the book.
Okay.
So Leonard is my maiden name.
Yes.
But it was actually the name that my parents chose when they came to this country.
Oh.
Because the family name was Levy. And although they were coming to America, they were still very, very frightened, understandably, after all the persecution of Jews in Germany and across Europe. But frankly, also in the United States, there was still a lot of anti-Semitism, as unfortunately there is rising in America today. So my father, encouraged in part by Eleanor Roosevelt, who really, you know, was promoting the melting pot theory of acceptance, it isn't as if we had a, you know, multisyllabic name. It wasn't hard to pronounce, but he decided for the sake of business and his children that he wanted something generic. So he picked Leonard out of the air. But the reason I said it, how to pronounce it is up for grabs, was because my mother always pronounced it Lynette.
French. I was thinking,
yes,
too.
French.
When I saw it, I thought, this is Lynette.
Absolutely.
It's not Leonard.
Yes.
But
yes.
How we are here, you know,
right.
In Paris,
so,
I said it's Leonard, but it's Lynette.
Go. Well, it's both.
It's both. Okay.
So depending on who I was with, I would say it differently.
I like Lynette, of course.
It's
a beautiful
funny
name. So there are a story, your life is surrounded by stories of all kind, nice, bad, and beautiful. And like this one is a new name, a new identity, a new life, mm-hmm. a new country. And now going to the book in some way or another, what strikes me is that your grandmother went to Chile. And as a Chilean, that is my first question.
Of course.
Did she go to the south of Chile? Where is she located in Chile?
Well, she actually, the first person to land in Chile from my family was my mother's brother,
okay.
Gunther. And he went there quite early. They actually had come to Germany to kind of recruit some of the German Jews who were unable to find work anymore. And so he went there to farm.
Which, to the south of Chile. So.
It was San Diego.
Oh, so he was farming in Santiago.
Well, I'm not sure. Well, he had a chicken farm.
Ah, okay, chicken farm. Okay.
So that's all I know about him.
Yeah.
But then later, he was joined by his younger brother and my grandfather, my maternal grandfather. And they got there in the nick of time. But my grandmother, unfortunately, was left caring for her mother, her aging mother, who she just didn't want to leave. And so she ended up, you know, having a very perilous journey by herself.
Sure, because she stayed there, she couldn't. But when she came to Chile, she reunited with the other family
members.
Other member family. And did she die in Chile?
Yes.
Oh, so she's buried in Chile.
Yes.
So have you been to Chile?
No.
You have to.
No.
This is the second part of the book. You have to know, my dear. You go, we go together.
Well, here's the reality. I have not been to Chile.
Yeah.
I have not been to Germany.
Still. Not yet.
Not yet.
Because you will have to.
I'm hopeful.
Yes, yes.
But I do have family in Chile I have never met.
I need to know their name. Later, when we finish, you will give me. I will do the research for you. And I will bring you a phone number. Because I think that this is in itself the second book. This has to continue. This cannot stop here. This is a very interesting sociological study, what you have done with all the research. Let's talk about the research because I love research. So it seemed that it wasn't that easy to get into public library. Where did you start this research for this book?
Well, actually, the reason this book kind of had its renaissance, I guess, is because during COVID, I had some time. I had finished my second book, Burying My Dead. And there's a sort of a genealogical theme in Burying My Dead. And I just kind of, you know, I really enjoyed that. But I had always thought about my own family as one where there were going to be a lot of dead ends. Because to find out information, I thought, would necessitate my going to Europe. And where so many, you know, records were lost during the bombardments of the war and such.
Sure, especially Germany.
Yeah, especially Germany. So, I didn't think it was going to get anywhere. But then I decided to kind of pick that up again, look at the anecdotes. And, you know, many decades had passed, and obviously the internet has changed markedly. And so instead of having to go to the library, I was able to sit at the in the privacy of my office, and do some amazing research. And I had learned those skills really in writing Burying My Dead, because that required lots of research. And I began to realize how many contemporaneous documents are available, you know, primary sources. So you could go to newspapers of the time. You could really tell what was happening at a time period without the lens, the long lens of history. So I started taking some of those anecdotes and matching them up to the historical surroundings that my parents were in. But then I found this box of letters. I mean,
beautiful.
Big box.
Beautiful.
And there were things my mom occasionally looked at, but had just been thrown willy-nilly into this box. Pretty miraculous when I think about it that they were saved to begin with, given their journey. And probably equally miraculous that I held on to them all those years because they moved from New York. My mother, that's where I grew up in New York, and we moved her to Omaha. So they came with her to Omaha. And then after she died and we moved to Portland, they came with me again. I had no idea what they were. Really, except that they were family letters. And when I began to look at them, you know, they're all in German. And my parents never spoke German, unless it was to people who only spoke German. They really didn't want us to learn yet.
No, but
they were
But memory, language is so close to emotion.
Yes.
And those emotions in them, they were so vivid, they didn't want to say anything.
No, they wanted to turn that page, start a new life.
Speak English only.
Yes, and so they, and they did, and they got very good at it, thank goodness. But because of that, I really had no understanding of what the letters were, even the typewritten ones. But I was lucky. I found a volunteer or two.
Ooh, yeah.
A woman by the name of Elizabeth Welton started with me, and then a woman named Andrea Tung. And those two people were incredibly instrumental in starting my journey and interpreting some of those many typewritten carbon copies that my father had kept. Because every time he wrote to his parents, he would type it and he would keep a copy. So I had all of his correspondence.
Nice.
But then I had all of these letters which were in the very old handwriting, the old German handwriting in script of my grandparents. And first of all, handwritings are always hard to interpret because they're handwritings. But it was also a time they had been in school before the turn of the century, so before 1900. And they had been taught a different kind of script, which was difficult to read even for, you know, contemporary Germans. And really, the greatest miracle of all is that my friend Andrea, who had been interpreting the German letters, connected with a person here in the States who had made his own little ancestral trip to Germany.
Okay.
And knew of a fellow who might be able to help. And as it turns out, he was able to read the actual letters. And then he would type them up in German, give them to my friend here in the States, and she would then put them into English for me.
Translate.
All of a sudden, I had
all
this roadmap
of
material
with
incredible detail. And even little notes from my maternal grandmother that basically told me from what town to what town they traveled during their escape, you know, which was just remarkable. So between the history on the internet and the anecdotes and then those letters,
I think the
really
letter
came together.
The letter in itself is a very good material. I am thinking about a book by Irene, one of the writers. The question I want to ask is, did you read any book that the action is during those years that to help you to put more content to your own, the story that you were trying to tell?
Not many, to be honest with you. I think I've always avoided reading too much that's similar to what I'm working on.
I think it's sometimes it's because we put our character, because your parent became your character, in a sociological environment, and that could be also obviously you did. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to remind our listener who our guest is, Betty Lennett, or Lynette Denny, and she's a writer, a grandma, and a woman who wrote this wonderful book called In the Wake of Madness. It's trying about her parents escaping from German, the Nazi. And we are alive, and our phone number here is 503-231-8187. So we welcome you to ask anything you want in relation to the subject, to her life, that she can answer, obviously, and to us. It's a very interesting subject because it covers one of the sad time of our history. I think it's interesting also to talk a little bit more about how was Hitler so immersed in Americas. How was the Nazi philosophy, if we may call philosophy, immersed in America? What did you learn through your research, Betty?
Well, I learned a certain amount in my research that was completely amplified, if I can pitch another book, by Rachel Maddow's book called Prequel, which is all about the Nazi philosophy in the United States. Really frightening.
May I ask,
yes,
did this start before the war or with the war? This group in the state. They were
before the war.
Before the war.
Before the war.
So then they find a place where they could develop.
Well, Hitler actually looked to the United States in many ways for some of his ideas. I mean, I think that's well known. One of the things that I hadn't known was just how the feelings of some of the senators and people in the House who would say things that were just so blatantly anti-Semitic or very pro-German. It was just fascinating to me that that was part of the public record. I was also amazed, and this is one of those things that hits you as a visual. I saw the German-American Bund put together a big rally, big Nazi rally. And I think, I'm not very good with dates. I believe it was 41. It was around the time my parents actually arrived in America. And it was fascinating to me. I mean, they packed that house. It was 20,000 people in the stadium. And on the podium, you could see this big banner of George Washington right next to the swastikas.
Oh, my goodness.
It was chilling.
Yes.
You know? And then, you know, the next day was hockey. I mean, it was like, it was craziness to think that. But my parents also always had this feeling they had to be on their guard. And I think that's, you know, partly because of their history and partly because even when they arrived, they knew that not everybody was a friend. Because they came before the bombardment at Pearl Harbor. So there was a lot of people who didn't want to go to the war, get into a war at all.
Yeah.
And certainly some of them were probably legitimately pacifists, you know. But many others didn't want to go into a war because they didn't want to protect Jews. You know, it was like that was their interpretation of what was happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, like they just wasn't worth it.
Yeah. Okay, I will make a pause in the sense that I will ask you to collaborate with this wonderful station. Today is the moment, perfect time to contribute to KBOO or campaign, because a generous group of KBOO or donor will match your gift one-to-one up to $20,000. You can do it over the phone, you can do it over the email, and by text KBOO OO to 44321. We need your collaboration, we need your sympathy, and we need your, collaboration, empathy, and solidarity, because here we are in Once Upon a Time talking about something very dramatic and important that Betty, Lynette, Denny put it into a book. It's not an autobiography, but it's a memoir, because she wrote the stories about her parents escaping from German Nazi. Okay, I have another, I have many questions, but this question about why did you do, it's a kind of basic question, but I need to ask, because it interests me why people do what they do. And what were your motivational, personal? I have the impression that the first motivational was as a child, as a daughter of these two people who were escaping, and in a very dramatic way, to leave a country in that way is awful. And so what motivated you? Since when did you start thinking, one day I need to have the full story, I will tell the story? You are a storyteller. This is what you are in this book. You are telling the story of your parents. And because you find all those wonderful letters and all the research that you did. But when this was born in you, that is my question.
Well, I think I've always felt that everybody has a story, and clearly this was part of my story. I mean, this was the story of my childhood. But the reality is my parents, you know, just as I was saying, they didn't speak German. Like many immigrants, they also didn't talk about their experiences.
Yeah.
I mean, my understanding of Nazism at the time was pretty simplistic. You know, I knew they were the bad guys.
Sure.
I knew my parents escaped. I knew an occasional little anecdote, you know, that would come up, like my father driving over the Pyrenees at night and his eyes getting inflamed and that sort of thing. But I didn't really know much about it until much, much later. And it really wasn't until my mom was old and I realized I was going to lose this.
Sure.
If I didn't start asking questions. So I started, and honestly, much to my amazement, those stories now started just tumbling out of her, which was marvelous. And you know, that became the impetus.
Perhaps she has her own process, and that was the right moment for her to express her experience, because it was less painful. Sometimes, not my case, but there are many people that they cannot even speak about what is going on because it's so painful. A person, an extrovert, is all the opposite. Tell the story because it needed to take it out. And so perhaps I am almost sure that was the right moment for her to say, this is something that my daughter should know.
I think that's true. I also think that because my father had died before her, that it was kind of a way...
She was a witness.
To remember.
She was a witness, only a character. She was also a witness.
She was there with him, obviously, through all of it. And I think talking about that also brought him back.
Yeah. Yes, the reminiscence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is make a very good point. This is what I have been telling our listener, that to write about your own life is a very healing process, because word in many ways they help you in that process. That is the reason because poetry exists. That is the reason because we pray. That is the reason because we use this wonderful language to communicate and to give affection and to receive affection, and sometimes not only affection, other thing also, that they're not necessarily nice. But I think it's very important to what you have done, and not everybody can write a book about it, but you can write your own thought about what has been important in your life and to share with us. This is what we want, to share with us.
Absolutely. And just as I wanted to preserve my parents' stories, I also wanted to be able to give them to future generations.
This is the second question I have. I think it's very important. And the other day, we have a Lily here that her parents immigrated from China. Mm-hmm. And she had her journal since she was 11 until now.
Wow.
And I told her, I said, you need to publish this, not tomorrow, but you need. And in your case, I don't have to tell you to publish. But the second part of the story, yes, you have to write it and do it as a second part, because maybe those letters should be published. And I think there is a great material there, as you know. And what is important, people don't understand that we have a responsibility to tell future generation how we live, what were our value, what kind of teacup we have, what kind of internet we have. Those daily life tools that we use that are important within emotion and within our history. So you did it because you thought you wanted to other generation to know and not to forget. Mm-hmm. Not, some people said, not forgive, not forget. Mm-hmm. I think it's remarkable important to give that message to new generation, because still there are people that say this never happened.
Yes, unfortunately.
I had a big discussion in Chile many years ago with a young man who said, I don't believe anything. This mm-hmm. never happened. Mm-hmm. So tell me about your sociological idea or purpose in writing this book.
Mm. Yeah. That's a big question.
Yeah, but it's here because...
Well, obviously, I want to raise awareness, among other things. I want people to understand the... How propaganda works, and how societies, nations can be fluid. I think when I was growing up, I had that simplistic idea. You know, America was perfect.
Yes.
Germany was evil, right? And
the duality, good and bad.
Yeah.
Good and bad.
Yeah. And, you know, now I, as an older person, I have seen how things can change. And when I was doing the research on Nazi Germany and all the years preceding it, you could see how it was a very gradual process and how the propaganda, you know, the kind of lies repeated continually just become normalized, and how people that you would consider good people started just either backing down or sticking their heads in the sand or accepting and embracing. And I think we all have to be wary of that in today's society.
Yeah.
There were an awful lot of chilling parallels when I was reading and researching the 1930s and writing about it to the world that I am experiencing today. With the rise in authoritarianism and just this kind of, I don't know, desire for easy answers. And it is pretty frightening. And obviously even the rise in hatred of all sorts, anti-Semitism among them, but of all sorts.
I agree. And I can relate perfectly to that situation because it's what I lived during the Pinochet dictatorship in mm-hmm. Chile, exactly the same. And sometimes, I don't know if it's a surviving skill, that you get so accustomed, so you are not amazed anymore
yeah.
with the situation. And still there are people that said, no, they were perfect. No, I don't care if they killed so-and-so-and-so. It's a way of denial and not accepting the reality, because perhaps those people don't want to recognize that they didn't do anything to change or to help somebody in need. You see, in Chile, for example, we have a wonderful museum called the Museo de Memory, mm-hmm. where I went and I couldn't finish seeing because it was so atrocious that I couldn't. And the same happened to me in Hungary. They wanted me to go to one of the places, and I said, no, I'm not going. I can't. I can't. Mm-hmm. It's too painful to mm-hmm. me. And this brings the other question, what is very interesting thought that you have here, and as human, very interesting, is, ay, señor, yes. Will I have the courage to hide someone, risk my life or my family if father needed me?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, these are the things that have run through my head my entire life, honestly. Is, first of all, why do people hate for no reason? I mean, it's like I understand that, you know, you would hate someone who has, like, done something to you in a specific way or a specific person. But this idea of hating whole groups of people is incomprehensible to me, to be honest with you. And then, of course, just the idea that that could morph into something the way it did in Nazi Germany and Nazi-occupied Europe, it is crazy to me. But that brings two questions to my mind. And one is, would I ever have the courage and the understanding and the savvy that my father and probably my mother did to know that it was time to get out? You know, how do you know what is that right moment when suddenly, instead of this is my home, I want to stay here, and that kind of philosophy, do you say, no, I'm in danger, or this is bad, I need to leave?
Yeah,
that's a hard point to get to.
I agree. I think we were in that situation in Chile. We were in that situation. We never thought, it was a moment where we talk about it, but my father said, I have never been in any party. I don't belong to any party. I have been, yes, a very conservative left. My mother said the same. Okay. But my brother was in jail, what we couldn't even imagine.
Yeah.
Why, you see? So sometimes, even if you are a closer circle, is not related to that any particular philosophy or political view, and suddenly the guy called and said, you know, I am in jail. So please, can you do something about it?
Right.
Do we have a call? Okay, very good. You can.
Hi, my name is John.
Yeah, John, hi, this is
with all the research this lady has done, just through her family, but I'm just looking at the big picture.
Yes.
How does she view Donnie J. Trump? Does she think that he's the new Hitler?
Good question.
Well, I think he has the
potential.
I mean, it depends. I don't like to throw around those terms, but clearly, I mean, he likes to stoke hatred. He uses the same playbook as Mussolini and Hitler have. He uses sometimes exactly the same words. He likes to divide people and set them against each other for his own benefit. So, yeah, I mean, I have great fear about Trump and, frankly, just all the people who follow him. I am afraid of the kind of propaganda in the form of so-called news that has become common, how many people will buy into conspiracy theories of all sorts. You know, all of that, I think, has unfortunately already shown how our country has changed, and if we're not careful, can change it in a much more permanent way.
Well, okay, yeah, I kind of agree. Of course, I have to, but it's just that seeing, what do you call swastikas behind some of his pep rallies.
Oh, uh-huh.
You know, I can't. It's gonna, you know, I see it's gonna happen.
Yeah, do you? And it's certainly possible, and that's why I have that question myself. Like, when is the time for me to get out of here? And now that I have a family, I have grandchildren, it's like that has become a much more complex question. And it's really hard. I mean, when you have a former president who's running a pretty successful campaign so far, despite everything that's being thrown at him, and you have even a candidate like Robert F. Kennedy, Kennedy, I'm sorry, whatever his middle initial is, who also has been accused of anti-Semitism. And you people like Elon Musk, who has, a tremendous amount of power over media as well as many other things, who it also has leanings, obviously, in that direction. I mean, it's a pretty frightening time.
Yeah, I think we have to be cautious, and I think we have to be alert. And also, that is the reason because she is here today, because we need to listen one time, more time, all the time, all this situation that people has been going through to try to avoid to get to that point. So we need the history. We need the real testimony, the witness of that time that help to understand and to minimize the risk, because we all want to feel safe where we are.
Yeah, well, I fear more. I don't really fear Donald Trump. I fear his lead. I mean, his followers.
His followers. You know? I agree.
Yeah, I mean, they are. You know, these guys are psycho, man.
Yes.
but anyway, well, thanks for your, giving me the time to ask the question.
Of course.
Thanks, John.
You are welcome, and we appreciate, and you keep calling and listen to our program, because every time we will try to bring interesting guests to speak about.
Yes, very good.
Yes.
All right.
Thank you,
John. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Again. Bye-bye.
Very good. So I remind the phone number 503-231-8187. So you recently reclaimed your German citizenship.
I did.
It's related to the subject we were talking.
Yes.
So because you are thinking about. So.
Well, you know, it's been interesting. I am part of a group through a publisher called Amsterdam Publishers.
Yeah.
They specialize in Holocaust memoirs.
And
so I have read more Holocaust-related material over the last year, since my book was done, but is
yes.
in the process.
Yeah.
And I have learned, all kinds of things, all kinds of stories. And forgive me, I forgot where we were going, Consuelo. What were you asking?
We were going about the reclaiming your German
citizen.
Oh,
that's right. So what I was going to say is that obviously, there are some people who are still in the camp I used to be in, which was, I don't want anything to do with Germany. I don't want to ever set foot in Germany. I don't want to give them a single dollar of my tourist dollars.
Yes.
You know, I felt that way for many, many years. But I think that in the process of doing this research and in the process of understanding where we are today, where Germany is today as a thriving democracy, that I learned, I learned to sort of understand that these societies are fluid. And I also felt that since their German citizenship had been taken away from them, that it was right for me to reclaim it, if not for myself, just for future generations, because that gives them the right.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I think you have to think about your grandchildren, and also it's something that you deserve, morally you deserve, because they took it away from your parents and they didn't have the right to do that. But also we have to remember Kennedy's sentence when he said, "My heart goes to Berliners." I told the sentence to a Berlin person that I met, and mm-hmm. he was so touched when I told him, because they suffered too. So it's no one group or the other. Of course, one group was more into, but many German people, my grandfather, a friend of my parents was an uncle to me, and he was from Germany. He escaped Germany and mm-hmm. went to Chile. And we felt a lot of respect. And we have also to think about the civil people that didn't have any. And how many people, and let's think about Schindler's List, the movie, the film, how many people helped?
Well, there obviously were a great many helpers.
Yes, yes.
But not most. It takes an enormous amount of courage.
Okay. Do we have another call? Wonderful. Hi.
Yes. Is this my turn to ask the question?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. I was going to ask. I was jogged by the caller who referenced Trump and how Trump has, of course, an openly observant Jewish son-in-law who's raising Trump's grandchildren as Jewish. And I don't really understand the silence of the Jewish diaspora and my own Jewish diaspora community in the United States and my relatives in Israel. I don't understand the silence as fascism has become normalized both in the Israeli government and in Jewish alliances in the diaspora. The fascists, you know, there were Jewish fascists who wanted to be part of the fascists in Italy with Mussolini. One of Mussolini's mistresses was a big ideological writer on fascism, Madame Sarfatti, and she has been almost completely written out of history. And I just think this is such a big problem that the Jewish diaspora itself would not open their mouth as fascism was rising within Netanyahu's cabinet.
Well, I think that the Jewish people are pretty, politically speaking these days, are a very diverse people. And I think you certainly have... you probably have Trump, sadly, have Trump supporters in this country who are Jewish, as you had Netanyahu's supporters in Israel, but you also have a very strong, you know, resistance to that among Jewish people, both in this country and against Netanyahu. So it's certainly ironic that the people who are often the subject and the first target of discrimination and worse, would even consider fascism or anything related to it. So, I mean, I agree with you entirely. It would be just really for all Jews and, frankly, for all people to recognize it for what it is. I mean, I think the reality is that when any society starts targeting Jews, they're really just the first. You know, it's like it's a first easy target because it's... As a people, we have been so persecuted for so many centuries. But inevitably, LGBTQ people come in, sometimes Catholic people come into play, African-American people, any people of color. I mean, you start dividing people up into those groups, and it's just a matter of picking each of us off, which is why we all should be standing for each other.
Yeah. I think so. And also one other reason, because one of the things that you said here, how could be that hate, how hate start, I think it start with the lack of social justice. There are so many people who are living under poverty in the world, not only in this country or my country, and they are very weak and sensitive to this kind of philosophy. So they get engaged because they want changes. Sometimes they don't even can imagine where those changes will take them or will take their own country or their own continent, like was in Europe. And it's scary because in some way my heart goes to these people because they need education, they need health, they need recreation, they need art, and they don't have access to those kind of things in the way everybody. So that is kind of the basic how this kind of ideology or philosophy start in a grassroots in some ways where basic people and then got to the elite or the elite at the same time that the basic, and because they want to remain and to have the power. In Chile now we have a German guy who is with the same that Trump. Exactly the same. The only difference is that he's younger and he has 7 children. But it's scary. So we are living the same situation, this kind of commencement of the Nazi or rebirth of the Nazi ideology is all over the world in one way or another. And we have to do as we can to help people to speak and to educate about the consequence. And this is reason why Betty is here today, and we are dedicated our show to her book and in honor her parents. We should honor everybody who were living under that situation, even if they survived.
I was going to ask a follow-up question on Chile, because it seemed like the previous president and administrations were so very different.
Yes.
And what were the conditions? Has there been a rise of social injustice in Chile to make this current person you're referring to so popular?
Yeah, bueno, what I said, I think the level of poverty, even we diminished considerable in over the past years, and now it's increasing. Life is very, yesterday I was talking with somebody who just came from Chile, and he told me, oh, to eat in Chile is very expensive. Yeah, it's expensive here. And to get the education, the teachers still have money that they haven't paid. To get to a hospital, you have to wait and a list for years sometimes to get a surgery, and those kind of problems, of course. So there are a lot of people who are angry, and because the elite is taking the whole power about political, even religious, religion also, the Catholic Church has been diminished because all the sexual abuse and everything that has been happening. And so we are in a very shaky situation right now in Chile, political. I am very concerned about. I vote for this president. I like him. He's a very talented young man, intelligent, and I call him the second Allende, because it reminds me Allende in many ways. And so what we can do, bueno, educate, and in education bring art to the younger people so they have something else to think and to recreate instead of drug or being unemployed. Okay, I have another call.
I appreciate you.
Okay,
sharing.
Thank you very
thank
much
you.
For calling. Nice question too. Okay, somebody else is there? Uh-oh. Somebody else is there? Yoo-hoo. Hello.
Mentioned different terminology. Yes, different terminology that's used. So one here is a settler colonialist, as if they're like, you know, American people moving west. They're land thieves is what they are. Okay.
So do you have a question?
Well, no. Another comment would be about don't read abridged books, because I had read, I think most people have in high school, The Diary of Anne Frank.
Oh, sure.
But I one time had a chance, and it's a big book. The unabridged version, and it got into like a lot of family stuff, like why did her parents favor her older sister, and blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to bore you, but the thing I noticed was as the Nazis were coming into Holland, anyway, but the laws changed gradually.
Correct.
First, Jews weren't allowed to do this, then Jews weren't allowed to do that, then before 7 o'clock, after 7 o'clock, could you know what I'm saying? Couldn't ride buses, couldn't ride bicycles.
Couldn't ride bikes.
Get it? Yes. And so I see a lot of the behavior of the Israeli government, and I have many Jewish friends and Jewish uncle and cousins, but it resembles Nazis.
Oh.
Nazi tactics. Calling people vermin, and Trump, he called people on the anybody on the left that thinks progressively is vermin. He said it. You know, I hate mentioning the guy's name, but these are really old German Nazi tactics that used against us, you know, people.
Okay, yeah. We appreciate your comment, and we share your thought, and we are almost ready to end the program.
I get you.
We appreciate your call, and I hope you keep calling for the next episode, because we will have
the
next episode with Betty.
We love you, Consuelo.
Oh, how nice. I love
Big
you
heart.
Too.
Big
Thank
heart.
You very much. Bye, my dear. Okay, here we are. So one more time to collaborate with our wonderful station and our listener to give to our campaign. Is the goal this time is to reach $20,000. Now is the perfect time to contribute, And because of generous group of KBOO, all donor will match your gift one-to-one up to $20,000. I want to say thank you to my new friend, because she's my new friend. And like I said, one more time, I want to honor her parents, her grandmother. And I am so pleased that some of her family is still in Chile. I will do the research, bring it to her, because she need to know. And so this way, I will take her to Chile, and she will do the interview.
I would love to have a guide.
Of course. And yes, I have experience about that too. And so we will write the second book. And it's a saga. This is a saga. That is what I am thinking about. And because more than ever, we need people to take time to write about. And so this way we can avoid another tragedy. Do you want to say something, Betty?
No, I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Okay.
It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, me too. I am so happy. And one more time, I thank you, KBOO, for giving me the opportunity to bring these wonderful people who are trying to make history and change the world every single day, included my dear Ender. Okay, now it's time for music, and I hope to be with you the other week. And we will bring somebody, or I will maybe be alone. I will talk about, I am thinking about what I am talking. I will prepare a promo so you can listen, and this way you will know what is next. And if you have any suggestion or anything, you can write to me, email to me, call me, whatever. I am here for you guys, and love you too. Bye-bye. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just